I'm Rick Ganley. You're listening to New Hampshire Public Radio. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It was called the Great Debate, a two-year period of rancorous argument in America over whether we should engage in World War II. Between 1939 and 1941, as Hitler moved across Europe and nations fell, our country was bitterly divided between isolationists and interventionists. The isolationists reflected an America still scarred from World War I and passionately opposed to entanglement overseas yet again. The interventionists included those deeply fearful of Hitler's aggression, especially for our own security, if the Nazis controlled all of Europe. Personifying these two camps were the two best-known men in America, President Roosevelt and celebrity aviator Charles Lindbergh. And now, a book by our guest today on The Exchange chronicles this great debate through how these two historical figures navigated it. The author is Lynn Olson. The book is called Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. Let's hear from you this hour. What questions, comments, or even memories do you have of this time and of this debate? What do you think we learned from it? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Lynn Olson joins us from D.C. And Lynn, it's great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, that image of World War II that most people have, myself included, Lynn, a time of great unity, of common purpose, common resolve, as one person put it, the good war fought by the greatest generation. But as you present in this book, this unity was hard won and slow to arrive. How so?
Well, you know, we have 20/20 hindsight when we look back at history. And yes, we think of it as the good war now, which it was. There's no question. It was a necessary conflict to save all of us, save the world from Hitler and Germany and Japan. But in the years leading up to Pearl Harbor, the extent of that evil was not as obvious as it is now. I mean, especially in America, because we were really protected. We were not part, obviously, of Europe. We had two oceans between us and what was going on in Europe and Asia. And so, and we didn't have the communications, the instant communications we have now. So people really didn't realize what was happening.
Yeah, well, the language that historians use to describe this great debate over that two-year period that your book is about, you know, the language is powerful. Savage debate, ferocious debate, bitter debate. I mean, people use the strongest language possible to describe this debate. What does this tell us, Lynn, about the depths of American feeling at this point in time?
Well, you know, the depth, as you have pointed out, was incredibly deep. It was very passionate, very bitter, because this debate focused about one of the most important subjects that we dealt with, which is the future, the very future of America. I mean, what were we going to remain an isolationist country as we had been for most of our history, you know, not wanting to get involved in foreign entanglements, or were we prepared to join the world? And that's what that debate was really about at its crux. It was going to affect virtually every person in this country, the outcome of that debate, whether we went to war or not. And so as a result, millions of people from all over the country got involved in it. It wasn't like debate over wars that came after that. It wasn't, you know, top down. It wasn't just in Washington and in Congress and the White House. It really involved the majority of the people in this country.
Well, and one of the reasons it was so bitter that you remind us of, we forget how scarred the country was, right, Lynn? After World War I, I mean, just 20 years or so before, we were still kind of recovering from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had been promised, the people of the United States had been promised that this was a war that was going to make the world safe for democracy. That's what President Woodrow Wilson said when we got into it. And it didn't. In fact, you know, there were many people who thought it made the world safe for Adolf Hitler. It had not done what it was supposed to do. The idealism that Americans had going into that war was completely dissipated at the end. You know, there was great disillusion in the country. The thought was, you know, we are never going to get involved in another European conflict again. We had been tricked into it. That was the feeling on the part of many people by the British and the French, who wanted us to come to their aid. And so the country was heavily anti-war at the beginning of this period, certainly 1939, 1940, and even going into 1941.
Well, talk a little bit more about that feeling that we'd been tricked by the British and the French last time. I was surprised by that.
The British particularly conducted an incredibly skillful propaganda war in this country in the years leading up to our getting involved in World War One. I mean, World War One broke out in 1914. We didn't actually get involved until 1917. And up to that point, the British were doing their best to get us into the war. And as I said, conducted an amazing propaganda campaign, which helped us get into this war. It did have an effect. And so afterwards, a lot of attention was directed at Britain and what it had done. The feeling in this country was also that the people who profited in America were big arms makers, munitions makers, and businessmen. That they were doing their best. They were in league with Britain to get us into the war.
Wow. So people felt like they'd been tricked by what some would say today is America's closest ally, Britain, but also our
Absolutely.
Own sort of corporate giants.
Absolutely.
And there was cynicism.
It was very similar to now, in a sense, you know, anti-big business spirit, you know, in the 20s and early 30s, mid-30s. You know, we're never going to do this again, was the feeling.
Well, and one more question about this, again, extreme reluctance to get involved in Europe again, stemming from this scarring from World War One. A lot of the political rhetoric used around World War One, safe for democracy, war to end all wars, and it didn't turn out that way. 20 years later, there they were at each other's backs again. You write that Americans just felt, look, just figure it out yourselves, Europeans. It's just not our problem anymore.
Right. I mean, and the idea was that we went to war to save you in World War One. I mean, that certainly France and Britain probably would have been defeated if America had not gotten into the war. And we went over there, you know, we were doing it for the most noble of reasons. And you didn't take the ball and run with it. I mean, you allowed Adolf Hitler to rise to power, and the thought was, the idea was, we're not going to do it again. We're not going to go over there again, and you know, and save you. This time, you're on your own.
Well, it gives you a sense of where the isolationists are coming from. The number for you to join our conversation with Lynn Olson, historian, former journalist. Her newest book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, is 1-800-892-6477. Join us with your questions, comments, personal memories, perhaps, of this time, 1939 to 1941, as the country engaged in a great debate over whether to enter World War II or to stay out. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. So that's one image, Lynn, that we have of World War II. Country united, common purpose, and you say yes, but not for the 2 years leading up to it. Another image that we have of World War II is of FDR as a strong, strong leader. But in this Angry Days time period, 39 to 41, that's not the portrayal you give of Roosevelt.
Yeah, I always like to say to people that, I mean, FDR was a great president. Absolutely no question about that. But you can't be great all the time. I mean, he was incredibly bold, resolute when he was elected in the New Deal period. There's no question about that. And he was incredibly bold and resolute once we got into the war after Pearl Harbor. But in those 2 years, those 2.5 years I write about in 1939 and 1941, he wasn't that decisive. Part of the reason was he had just been defeated. He had had his two worst political defeats of his presidency just a year and a half, 2 years before all of this happened. He had tried to pack the Supreme Court in 1937 and was decisively defeated in the Senate. And then he tried to get rid of some of his congressional opponents, Democratic congressional opponents, in the next congressional election. And he was decisively defeated on that, too. So in this incredibly important period when Hitler and Mussolini are coming to power, he's really at the lowest point of his presidency. And he totally lost the idea, which he had had up to that point, that the American people were solidly behind him. And he really didn't regain that confidence until Pearl Harbor, I think. And so for those 2.5 years, he very much wanted to save Britain, and he very much wanted to end German aggression, but he was really concerned, he was really hesitant, he was really fearful of the isolationist mood in this country, particularly in Congress. You know, the congressional isolationism was very strong. And he really was afraid of, I think, of going against that.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about that isolationist movement, again, sometimes led by Lindbergh. That's a huge part of this book. But you also write that Roosevelt was ill partly during this time period, too. He was just exhausted.
He was. I mean, remember, he had just been elected to his he was in his second term. And then in 1940, which is part of my book, he was running for a third term, and he was tired. He was a very tired man. He had been through some of the most extraordinary, extreme crises in this country's history. And my impression is that he was more ill than people thought. And, you know, especially beginning in 1941, going 1942, he was just tired. He really was exhausted.
So beaten down by political defeats, beaten down by just feeling tired. You write there were times when he would just kind of retreat for no reason. And you know, people needed decisions about these terrible things that were happening in Europe. And he was just kind of behind closed doors.
Well, especially, as I said, in 1941, you know, he won the 1940 election. It was a controversial election because he was running for a third term, which had never been done before. He won it, and many people, especially on the interventionist side, believed, all right, now he's through that, and now he can pick up the baton and he can really lead. Well, he didn't, and that was the period that you're talking about. He kind of retreated and was out of public eye for weeks on end, and people were getting very not only uncertain, but upset. They didn't know. I mean, Britain was right on the verge of being defeated.
Right.
And we were not stepping up to the plate. And there was a lot of questions about, you know, A, what's wrong with the president, and B, will we ever, you know, get to the point where we're going to help Britain?
What do we do about this? And coming up, we'll talk about Charles Lindbergh, his role with the isolationists, and we'll hear from you. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match their employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More with author Lynn Olson and her new book, Those Angry Days on the Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, ongoing battles over federal land management in western states. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Dairy Field School, inspiring students in grades 6 through 12 to excel in school, college, and beyond. Enrolling now for summer programs at dairyfield.org/summer. From the New Hampshire Trust Company, a locally owned and managed firm providing trust and investment management services throughout New Hampshire, nhtrustco.com. And the Ogunquwa Playhouse production of the Rock and Roll Celebration set in the fabulous 50s, Greece, on stage May 21st to June 21st. Tickets at ogunquwaplayhouse.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with historian and author Lynn Olson about her latest book called Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, thoughts, maybe even personal memories about those years and that two-year debate that this country had over whether to enter the war or stay out. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. So, Lynn, we talked before the break about Roosevelt. Let's talk about Charles Lindbergh, because he's the other main character. He and Roosevelt are right on the cover of this book together. Celebrity aviator, handsome, legendary. Reading the book, Lynn, I didn't realize how huge a figure he was. Just remind us of what a giant deal Charles Lindbergh was when he made that flight across the Atlantic.
Well, when he did that in 1927, he did become the most famous man in the world. That, you know, in a way, that was really a stunt flight, but nobody had done anything like that. He flown solo across the Atlantic. And it was the the late 1920s, and America was really hungering for a hero. We had been through a time of disillusion after World War One, a time of cynicism, flappers, you know, having a good time, and heroism was not in great supply at that point. And so here you had, as you said, this young, handsome, modest pilot who appears out of nowhere and does something that no one else has ever done. And even before he took off, he was, you know, the center of attention in this country and the world. And then when he actually did it, and pretty much nobody thought he was going to be able to do that, the whole focus of the world centered on this one tall, blonde, young aviator. And he was not prepared for it. It did not stop. That maelstrom of celebrity enveloped him and never let go. And he was a man that couldn't really deal with it very well. He was a very solitary guy, a very reclusive guy. He didn't like people that much. And so the more he resisted it, the more, you know, the press and the public wanted to know everything they could about him, and they pestered him incessantly. And so it was a fight between him and the press and public that ended really with the kidnapping and murder of his firstborn son. So this really scarred him. I mean, the fact that he became number one celebrity in the world, he just couldn't cope with it. He couldn't deal with it.
Well, and just remind us briefly where he came from. I mean, there were other people who joined this contest that was held to see who could make that flight across the Atlantic. They were well-known aviators, backed by a lot of money, and Charles Lindbergh just kind of appears out of nowhere, right?
That's right. He was a former airmail pilot. He came from Minnesota. His father had been a congressman, and so he had spent some time in Washington growing up. He was basically an only child, kind of a lonely, rootless existence, going back and forth between Washington and Minnesota. Really had no friends growing up, and people didn't remember much about him, the people he went to school with. He never dated, but he loved tinkering, he loved machinery, and eventually he loved flying. That was his obsession. That was what he cared about most in life. And so when this contest was announced about flying solo to France across the Atlantic, as you say, all these very well-known, very well-connected pilots signed up, and then you had this lone young airmail pilot, former airmail pilot from Minnesota, who had put together a small combine of businessmen from St. Louis, who helped finance this stripped-down little plane called the Spirit of St. Louis, you know. And so his story was just tailor-made, obviously, for attention. And then when he did it, of course, then it just went up, you know, so many other levels.
Well, and I could ask you a bunch more questions about Charles Lindbergh just on him. We could do a whole hour conversation just on him because he's a fascinating character. But just jump ahead a little bit for us, if you could, Lynn. So you talked about the paparazzi, the media frenzy. It was very stressful for him and his wife. And ultimately, this terrible kidnapping and murder happens. And so they say, to heck with it, and they go to Europe, right? And they just escape it all for a while.
That's right, yeah. He just wanted out of the U.S. And so he went to first to England and then to France, and both of those countries gave them the refuge, the privacy that they needed so badly. And so they spent several years in Europe. And during that time, he went to Germany. He was invited to Germany by Hermann Göring, the head of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, to come and see, you know, what they were doing in terms of their air force. And the whole idea, this is obviously, Hitler was gearing up for war at that point, and Göring wanted to impress Lindbergh and to show him that the Luftwaffe was so incredibly powerful, it would be unbeatable. And he was using Lindbergh, and it worked because Lindbergh was just totally blown away by how good the Luftwaffe was. It was not nearly as powerful as he thought it was, but and so he basically went back and told Britain and France and the U.S. that it was going to be no use going up against Germany if a war broke out, because Germany could not be beaten, and especially in terms of their air force.
So he kind of did their propaganda work for them, neat and easy.
He certainly did. And people believed him. I mean, the French and the British particularly, America to some extent, it did work. He certainly was not responsible, for example, for the Munich conference when Britain and France gave in. But his report, his discussion of that whole subject did have an influence, I think.
Our phone number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. The book we're talking about today is called Those Angry Days by historian Lynn Olson. It's about Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's fight over World War II, 1939 to 1941, a not very well explored time in our history as America had this great debate over whether or not to get involved in World War II. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. So when and how did Charles Lindbergh get involved with the isolationist cause?
Well, he had decided, when he was in Europe and he saw that war was coming in 1939, it was pretty clear by early 1939 that war would indeed break out. He decided that his mission in life, at least at that point, was to go back to the U.S. and do everything he could to keep us out of war. He truly believed that Germany was unbeatable and that the United States should concentrate on its own defense and not get involved in what he considered a European war, totally European war. And it was an interesting decision for him to make because he hated, as I said, he hated the whole idea of getting back into that, you know, that cauldron of celebrity and publicity that he had escaped from just a few years before. But he decided that it was his mission in life to do this, so he came back in the spring of 1939, and at that point he was really by himself. He was not allied with other isolationist groups, but because he had the celebrity, because he was so well known and people respected him so much and listened to what he had to say, it was not surprising that other isolationists saw him as their leader, which he really was. He was the unofficial leader of the isolationist movement during this whole period.
Well, and I want to ask you about which groups latched onto him and how that went. But getting back to his assessment that, you know, Germany's unbeatable and they're very impressive and, you know, Britain and the Brits are sitting around drinking tea and the French, who knows about them? You know, he was kind of dismissive of Britain and France, even though those two countries had given him refuge during this difficult time. And you write, Lynn, though, that Lindbergh was not alone in America in thinking, look, Germany's very impressive, unbeatable. Look at their economy. Look at their military. Look how disciplined they are. A lot of folks in the United States felt more admirable or admiring of Germany than they did of France and Britain.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there's no question. And that was true in Britain and France as well. There were a lot of people who thought that Hitler was handling it the right way, and that, you know, that he was getting Germany back up after their defeat in World War One. One of the things that really struck me, that surprised me, was that attitude was very strong in the American military. You know, at the high levels, especially people in the army, really kind of admired what Germany had done in terms of rebuilding themselves and their armed forces, even though they weren't supposed to be rebuilding their armed forces. That was against the Versailles Treaty, but they had been. And they really admired the professionalism of the Luftwaffe and the Wehrmacht, the army. As more came out about what was happening to the Jews, for example, the persecutions of others, that idea, that admiration started to dissipate. But there's no question that you know, in the late 30s, that there were a lot of people who actually did feel that way.
Our phone number again on the exchange for you to join us with author Lynn Olson. Her new book, Those Angry Days, is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Chris is calling from Kittery, Maine. And Chris, good morning. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead, Chris.
I'd just like to point out when Lucky Lindy, as they called him, was in, he left the U.S. to escape publicity about the death of his baby. And he lived in Kent in England. And the American Air Force actually asked him to travel to at their invitation, traveled to Germany to report on Nazi aircraft development, and that's what led him into contact with the Nazis. And he was a great anti-Semite. Him and Ford, the car manufacturer, some of his stuff. When Germany invaded Poland, for instance, he made the statement, which guard ourselves against attack by foreign armies and dilution by foreign races and the infiltration of inferior blood. Yep. Aviation is the thing about to permit the white race to live it all in a pressing sea of yellow, black, and brown.
You know,
he was terribly anti-Semite.
Chris, we should definitely talk about this. Thank you very much for calling in. And I did want to get to this with you, Lynn. Two things very quickly. Chris, thank you. He says, look, the U.S. Air Force asked Lindbergh to assess Germany's capabilities. That's in the book as well, isn't it?
Yeah. As I said, the invitation to Germany came from Hermann Göring, but the idea had been presented to Göring by the American military attaché in Britain. In Berlin. Sorry, he wanted to find out. The military attaché wanted to find out more about the Luftwaffe, and he didn't. He couldn't get information, and he thought he could get some information through Lindbergh, and that was true. So yes, the impetus for the invitation to come to Germany did come from the American military attaché.
And Chris is so right. We really should talk about Lindbergh's reputation as an anti-Semite. He made some speeches that did not come off too well.
The speech that in particular that prompted the accusations of anti-Semitism was given in September 1941, two months before Pearl Harbor. In Des Moines, Iowa, in which he said that the three main groups that wanted to get us into the war were Britain, the FDR administration, and American Jews. And in the course of that speech, he did make remarks that were anti-Semitic, there's no question. But what I emphasize in the book, and I don't excuse it, and I agree that they were anti-Semitic, there's no question, but he was also reflecting the spirit of a large part of this country.
He wasn't the only person feeling that way.
He was not the only person feeling that way. There was a very deep streak of anti-Semitism, overt anti-Semitism in the United States that you could find basically in all levels of society. So what he did was voice it publicly when many, many people felt that way and talked about it but did so in private. So that speech was kind of a pivotal moment in the isolationist movement. After that, Lindbergh's reputation was very much damaged. He had lost the clout that he had had. And the isolationist movement never really recovered from that speech.
That was the fall of when, Lynn? 40 or 41?
1941.
Okay.
1941.
So almost at the end of this great debate.
Almost at the end of this whole battle, yeah. But from then on, it just rapidly, the air went out of the isolationist movement almost totally. By then, it was really a spent force, after his speech, I think.
Well, Chris, thanks again for joining us. The number for you to join us with your questions or comments about this fascinating period of time in our history, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Another turning point that you write about, Lynn, is when the Nazis marched into Paris. And you write that, before with Czechoslovakia and, other countries that Americans really didn't have any familiarity with, they maybe shrugged it off. But boy, when the Nazis rolled into Paris, that was another matter.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. To America, again, most Americans had never traveled abroad at that point. And especially the countries that Hitler went after first, they were in Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe. So Czechoslovakia and Poland, really didn't resonate with Americans. But when Hitler, launched his blitzkrieg of Western Europe, which ended with the fall of France and German troops marching into Paris, well, that was something Americans knew about. They may not have been there, but they had seen movies about Paris. They knew the Eiffel Tower, the cafes, the beautiful women. They had an affinity toward that country and that city. And when that happened, Americans finally started waking up and saying, oh my goodness, you know, if Paris can fall, then the next will be London. If London falls, we are alone. This country, the United States, is alone against a united Europe dominated by Nazi Germany. And that's when this debate really went into high gear, when the stakes were suddenly raised so high that Americans realized, okay, we have to decide what we're going to do here.
Yeah, well, and you also write that the falling of these European countries so quickly and easily, really, led rise to a theory believed by many that there was a so-called fifth column in these countries and that there might be one operating in this country, meaning, you know, Nazi instigators, spies, underground operators who kind of softened up these countries so that it was easier for Hitler's forces to come through. Just give us a brief description of what this fifth column was and how that kind of inflamed fears in this country.
It was certainly true in Europe. That was the explanation that France and Belgium and the Netherlands, et cetera, Norway, came up with, or at least some people thought, that they couldn't possibly have fallen so quickly because they were not militarily strong enough or united enough. It was because of internal subversion. It was because of the population, some members of the population of those countries who were actually in league with Germany. And that was a very popular opinion. It wasn't true, by the way, but it was a popular opinion. And so we had that same belief here, that, you know, that there are many pro-German or later pro-Japanese, but pro-German, you know, people in this country who were working secretly with Germany. The Roosevelt administration very much pushed this idea that there were all these fifth columnists busily working away against our own national interest, which again was not true. But they actually felt that way. Roosevelt actually did feel, I believe, that this fifth column was very, very active in the United States. And it resulted in a lot of problems with civil liberties.
Yeah, well, and he tied
period.
Charles Lindbergh to this fifth column, too, which maybe we'll talk about
Absolutely.
In just a moment. The number for you to join our conversation with Lynn Olson is 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, ongoing battles over federal land management in western states, and then the Wright brothers and the intense rivalries that fueled the early years of aviation. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather for today, sunshine, high temperatures, lower 70s for the North Country, ranging to lower 80s in southern parts of the state. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, awarding $5 million in scholarships each year to promising students in need across the state. Information at nhcf.org. And Mill Falls at the Lake, Four Inns offering Winnipesaukee Lakefront Lodging, 7 restaurants, 12 marketplace shops, the Cascade Spa, and Ecal Lake Activity Center. MillFalls.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, an update on the so-called Arab Spring. Today in The Exchange, we're re-examining America's contentious debate over whether to enter World War II or not with the author of a new book, Lynn Olson. The book is called Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. You can join us with your thoughts. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Lynn, Gary posted a comment on our Facebook page. He says, I would like to hear your guests speak about the influence that Ambassador Kennedy had and how that shaped JFK and his policies as he came into office as congressman, senator, and president. Now, the elder John Kennedy is in this book, Lynn.
Yes, he is. He actually was a student at Harvard during this period. His father had been, and still was, American ambassador to London. And he was an isolationist, as was his father. His father was a very strong isolationist and believed that the U.S. should stay as far away from this war as possible. And John F. Kennedy was a strong supporter of America First as a Harvard senior. America First was the most influential isolationist organization in the country, and he actually founded by a group of college students at Yale. And John Kennedy, JFK, sent a check of $100, which was quite a lot of money back then, to America First, saying, you know, you're doing the right thing.
Wow, and so I was surprised to read that. Yeah, because didn't JFK serve valiantly in World War II?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what I point out is that this group, the founders, the young student creators of America First, and the many, many, many college students who became part of America First, didn't know that they were going to be the greatest generation in a few years. They, you know, all they knew was World War I. And they knew that if we got into another war, they were going to be the ones who were going to be on the front lines. And they looked back at World War I and said, you know, this didn't do what it was supposed to do, and we don't want to get into a war. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of Vietnam in the 1960s because, you know, there was a big anti-war movement on college campuses before World War II that I don't think most people realize.
So by 1941, as the U.S. goes back and forth in this great debate, the British are getting hammered. I mean, they're really the last ones standing in Europe. What is Churchill saying to Roosevelt? You write that he was just, you know, furious doesn't even begin to describe it.
Now, I mean, he was just over, you know, over the top in terms of being to Roosevelt. Don't you understand that if we fall, you guys are going to be next? And that we are going to fall unless we get aid from you. And he said, he repeatedly said that in cables and phone calls, et cetera. And again, Roosevelt wanted to help him. He really did want to help him in Britain. But he was so politically weak at that point, in his opinion anyway.
Yeah, he perceived he was.
He perceived he was. Many people around him, his advisors, members of his cabinet, thought that wasn't true. The American people were ready to follow him at that point. But Roosevelt himself was never convinced of that. So, yes, you had Churchill just begging him over and over and over again to come to Britain's aid. And he wanted to, and he did take steps, you know, going up to Pearl Harbor. There's no question he did. But he was very, very reluctant to move quickly. And Churchill thought quite rightly that if he didn't move faster, that Britain was going to go down.
Well, and most of us learned in high school about, you know, Lend-Lease and the Neutrality Acts and so forth. So these, you know, there are these sort of backdoor ways that Roosevelt tries to help by sending stuff, although some of that stuff, at least early on, isn't great, but it's better than nothing.
Right, exactly. And that was part of his being kind of pushed by – he was pushed a lot by – ordinary citizens groups to do that. And one of them was sending old American destroyers to Britain.
Old ships.
In the summer of 1940, which he did. It was not through Congress. He got a lot of flack for that, but he did approve it. But it took a lot of pushing and shoving on the part of other people, including, as I say, ordinary citizens, to get him to that point.
How many people do you think, I mean, I know it's hard to gauge public opinion, but at this point when Britain really is the last one standing and there are these, you know, images of just the citizens of London just enduring day after day after day of bombings, what about public opinion at that point in terms of, you know, London, if London falls, Manhattan's next?
American public opinion was shifting, and much of that was due to what was going on in Britain. You know, when the Battle of Britain and the Blitz occurred in the summer and fall of 1940, before that, most Americans wanted to stay out. I mean, many Americans were willing to provide some aid to Britain, but the overall mood in the country was still heavily isolationist. When Americans saw what was happening over there, then they began to think, okay, we do have to save Britain. Part of the reason for that was the reporting from England by people like Edward R. Murrow, you know, the CBS, the great CBS correspondent, who basically was saying, you know, the underlying message of his reports about what was going on there was America has to get into this war if we're going to save this country, or if this country is going to be saved. And the American people started responding to that.
Yeah.
So you began to see a major shift in American public opinion from really the summer of 1940 through 1941. It was, you know, it was gradual, but the mood, there's no question, it changed in that period.
Well, and one of the things for me that was interesting as a journalist is to read about the huge influence of people like Murrow and Dorothy Thompson and so forth. But I won't get into that with you right now, Lynn. But that's, these journalists played a big role in this effort. I want to go to our listeners again. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Sally's been waiting in Thornton. Hi, Sally. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Thank you, and good morning. Does Lynn Olson see any relevance to America today of that lengthy national dialogue about getting into World War II? As we engage in armed conflicts around the world.
Okay. Sally, thanks a lot for calling. You may have to put on your former journalist hat for that, Lynn. But go ahead.
Well, I do think that a lesson can be learned about, that's a great question, by the way, a lesson can be learned about how we went to war in terms of World War II, because I think that dialogue, that public dialogue, that very long public dialogue, helped unify us as a country. The issues surrounding whether or not to get into the war were absolutely aired out. Virtually everybody in this country knew what was involved. The pros, the cons were debated and debated and debated. So by the time of Pearl Harbor, people knew what, you know, that we were going to probably pay a heavy price, which we did for getting into the war, but most people thought it was necessary. And I think that kind of public debate is essential whenever we are considering getting into a war or, you know, some major shift in foreign policy. And it shouldn't be a top-down thing, you know, only in Washington, only in the White House, only in Congress. The people should and must get involved in it.
Well, and you do write that when the U.S. finally entered the war, full scale, as you said, Americans were strongly united because they'd had this long, great debate. They felt informed. They felt like they'd examined it closely. On the other hand, Lynn, and you, I think you know where I'm going to go with this, while this debate was taking place in the U.S., millions of Europeans, especially European Jews, were being killed. London was being flattened. I mean, you know, if you're from a European perspective, it's maddening, this great debate.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. One of my favorite lines, and I use it in the book, from Winston Churchill, is you can count on Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And I think that just sums up the frustration and the anger on the part of him, his country, and the rest of the world at our kind of dithering during this period. And there's no question we were dithering. But again, you can understand it from an American viewpoint as well. You know, people were not convinced until very late that we needed to get involved in it. But it just shows that, you know, the how history can be, you can be right on the edge. I mean, how much longer would Britain have held out before, you know, if we had not gotten into the war in December 1941? I don't know. But I don't think it would have been very long. So
they were pretty badly battered at that point.
They were right on the edge of going down to defeat.
Well, and just to wrap things up, so Pearl Harbor, December 1941, changes everything. As everybody knows, the U.S. enters the war against Japan. But you remind us, Lynn, Roosevelt just declared war on Japan, not Germany. I think some people may be surprised to remember that.
That's right. Yeah. On December 8th, Roosevelt went before Congress and asked for a declaration of war only against Japan, which was something that the people around him, again, members of his cabinet, said that he should go after both, that both Japan and Germany.
Really? His advisors said do both.
Do both, yes, that we should declare war against both. But Roosevelt wouldn't do it. He said, no, we're going to basically focus on the country that attacked us. And it took three more days before Hitler declared war on us. We did not declare war on Germany first. And those 3 days, there was an enormous amount of angst, now, obviously not only in this country, but in Britain, et cetera, because if we had not declared war, if Hitler had not declared war against us, we probably would not have declared war against Germany for some time. I think we definitely would have gotten into war with Germany eventually, but I think it would have taken some time. And again, you know, would Britain be able to hold out? They would then be facing a two-front war against Japan and Germany. Again, they're on the verge of defeat. You know, there are a lot of what-if questions surrounding that whole issue.
Yeah, boy, I have so many for you, and I know you can't answer them, but, you know, the what-if America had gotten involved earlier, how many lives would have been saved,
right?
How many people would not have been sent to concentration camps? You know, if Germany had not declared war on the U.S., how long would have London lasted? It's interesting, though, Lynn, reading about Hitler's decision to go to war against the U.S., you write that a lot of his advisors said, don't, you know, wake the sleeping giant.
Absolutely. I mean, many, many people around Hitler were saying, do not declare war against the U.S., you know. And we were a sleeping giant. Hitler knew, too, you know, our industrial capacity, capability, that basically it was one of the main reasons the Allies won the war, one of maybe, if not the main reason. And so they were saying, don't do it. At that point, Hitler had it with Roosevelt and the U.S. He had tried very hard to prevent the U.S. from declaring war. But, I mean, he really hated Roosevelt. It was his own decision. He was the one that came up that decided, no, we're going to go to war against the U.S. And it was, I think, one of the two major mistakes he made in the war. That was one, and invading the Soviet Union was the other.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I didn't realize that this was kind of his decision. A lot of people were saying, don't do this.
Totally his decision, yeah.
Well, and of course, we talked earlier about Charles Lindbergh and his role in the isolationist movement, and Roosevelt kind of on the other side, wanting to help Britain finally bring the U.S. into war. It's fascinating what happens to Charles Lindbergh once the U.S. is fully engaged against Japan, against Germany, against Italy. Lindbergh tries to redeem himself, Lynn. What does he do?
Lindbergh, from the moment he heard about Pearl Harbor, Lindbergh disappeared from public view. He issued a statement saying, I was against this war, but now that it's come, I will support it. And he did. For the rest of the war, he did not say anything publicly against Roosevelt or his conduct of the war. He wanted very, very much to get back into the Air Corps, the Air Force, and he wanted to fight. And Roosevelt would have none of it. He would not allow him back into the military. So as a result, he had a lot of friends in the military, Lindbergh did, who encouraged him to go to the Pacific as a civilian consultant to aircraft companies and to basically to the Air Corps. So he did. I mean, he was actually dressed in a uniform, Air Force uniform. He flew American fighter planes to test them, basically, and to help improve them. But he also flew on actual combat missions. And many people over there obviously knew what he was doing, and I suspect Roosevelt did too. But he did, and he spent 2 or 3 months in the Pacific as an actual pilot.
Yeah, he kind of sneaked in then.
He sneaked in with the help of friends in the Air Corps, you know, top people in the Air Force. And by all accounts, it was the happiest he had been in years. You know, that's what Charles Lindbergh loved. He loved to fly. And so, you know, he had the time of his life. He actually shot down a Japanese Zero. He was almost shot down himself. But, yeah, he did.
Well, and he made some major improvements. I mean, I think you wrote that he helped expand the fighting capacity of U.S. pilots. So he contributed.
Yes, he did. He made a number of improvements in these planes that helped save lots of pilots' lives, actually. And he was very popular over there. You know, he was about 20 years older than most of the young American pilots, but they thought he was wonderful.
Well, Lynn, what's stuck with you after writing this book? I mean, you're a historian. You've looked at this time period for a long time, but often from the British perspective. What about this period, this great debate, stuck with you and that you hope will stick with your readers?
Well, I like the fact that Americans came together after a long extended discussion about what was good for this country. You know that it was an exercise in democracy, and I would like to see America do that again. You know, we have so many voices out there screaming about what is good and what is bad for America. I'd like to see American citizens actually do more themselves, you know, and participate in this kind of, discussion about where our country is going.
So engaging at that citizen grassroots level. Everybody
Absolutely.
Takes part. Everybody's got an opinion.
Absolutely.
Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And it was fascinating for me to learn more about Roosevelt during this time and about Charles Lindbergh. Lots I didn't know there. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Lynn Olson, historian and author. Her latest book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. By the way, you can find an excerpt from the book on our webpage, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, what happened with the Arab Spring? 3 years after uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa toppled regimes and brought hopes for democracy, progress seems to have stalled in all but one country. Now, with civil wars, political crises, street violence, and sectarian fighting, many observers wonder if the Arab Spring left the Arab world any better than before. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners, and from Edward Jones, a financial services firm serving individuals and business owners. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, a member of SIPC. And Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The federal government owns almost half the land west of the Mississippi. Strict usage rules apply to some areas, including those designated as wilderness and national parks. But for 650 million acres of federal land, the interest